Hi! Hey, welcome to The Cordial Catholic, a podcast for non-Catholics, new Catholics, those looking to dig deeper into the Catholic faith. I'm K. Albert Little, an evangelical convert to Catholicism, and this podcast is based on one particular idea. It began for me when a Protestant pastor I was working for asked me the question, what's more important, the Bible or tradition? That led me on a deep dive into the history of my faith, the history of the Bible, the canon of the Bible, the early church, the Reformation, what happened all up in there and beyond, and led me to the very first time to looking into the Catholic Church in the Catholic Church's own words. And it was then that I realized what I thought I knew about Catholicism was based in large part on misinformation and more often than not on simple misunderstandings. Well, this podcast serves to fill in that same gap, the gap between what you think Catholics believe and what we actually do. Each week, I have a real Catholic conversation with a real Catholic thinker from the heart of the Catholic Church. No misinformation here. And this week, I am joined by my good friend, Rod Bennett, for something a little different, maybe. We are answering a question that was really brought to my mind by an evangelical friend of mine who is searching for a new church. They are in between churches. And he asked me to pray for him. So I was. And then I thought, well, how do you find a new church? The exercise of, as an evangelical, finding a new church. And that led me to begin to think about this topic. What paradigm do you inherit when you're looking for a church? How do you do that? How should you do that? What does the Bible give us in terms of instructions for how to do that? And really, what does that practice kind of mean? And so I have brought in my friend, Rod Bennett, early church historian, to really ask the question, looking for a new church, why not Catholic? What role would the Catholic Church, what kind of reasons would the Catholic Church have for being a church in contention for a church that you're looking for if you're looking for a new church? And what does it mean to look for a new church? What are those markers you should be looking for in that search? Well, Rod's just full of amazing insight in this episode. Rod, like me, is a convert to Catholicism by way of the early church fathers, by looking at these kinds of questions. What should a church look like? What did the church look like? What happened to that church? How do I find a church? Is there a church? A singular church that Christ founded? Does that exist? Did it exist? These kinds of questions. This is such a fantastic episode. I hope you like it. I hope you love it. I hope you dig deeply into this because, guys, this is just amazing stuff here that I hope gives you some food for thought to answer that question of how do you find a new church and why not Catholic? This episode is brought to you by our patrons at patreon.com/cordialcatholic and our one-time sponsors at paypal.me/cordialcatholic. You guys know this. This is not my full-time job, so your support of this show makes it possible to week after week spend time recording, producing, getting all this thing happening each week on this show, and I thank you for your support of that. And I have a new patron to thank this week. Thank you, Janessa, for your fantastic support of the show. You are amazing. And thank you to everyone who is supporting this show with your prayers and your financial gifts. Thank you so much. And now, without any further ado, my absolutely outstanding, fantastic conversation with Rod Bennett on how we look for churches. And, well, is the Catholic Church a contender in that? Obviously, yes. But why? Please listen and enjoy. Hey friends, welcome back to the show. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. If you are listening on podcasts, on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify, please just press pause right now and leave a rating or review for the show. That helps to push the podcast out to new listeners and grow the audience for awesome episodes like this one. If you are watching on YouTube, thanks for watching. Please make sure you subscribe to this channel, like this video, interact in the comments. It's a scary and sometimes entertaining place. And make sure you hit the bell to get notified of every video that comes out on this channel every week. week. Guys, it is my absolute pleasure to welcome back to the show Rod Bennett. He is, of course, an evangelical convert to Catholicism, the author of the best-selling Four Witnesses, the Early Church in Her Own Words book. Other books include The Apostasy That Wasn't, Four More Witnesses in the Early Church, Scripture Wars, These 12, The Gospel Through the Apostles' Eyes, Bad Shepherds, and a bunch of other awesome books, Rod. And he is the co-host, along with his son, Jack, of the Popcorn Cathedral on YouTube. Guys, this is awesome stuff. I just get sucked in, Rod, his episodes. It's a little bit of, like, pop culture, just deep into different, like, awesome bits of culture and intersections of amazing different things I wouldn't even consider. I can't describe it very well. Maybe you can afterwards, Rod, but welcome back to the show. Thank you for being here, Rod. And hello.
Well, it's great to be here. I always enjoy spending time with Keith, the great Keith Little. And don't worry, you're very cordial. It shouldn't be anything scary tonight.
Yeah. We'll see about that. We'll see about that, Rod. I want to say before we go too deep into this, Rod, that I was looking back through the archives of our conversations over time and when we've talked before, and I had to go all the way back to like episode 6 of this show, Rod, over 4 years ago, to our very first interaction talking about the apostasy that wasn't. So these conversations go, I mean, in podcasting years, way back.
In this very ephemeral art form, yeah. 4 years is an eternity, I guess.
It is. It absolutely is. And I got to say, whenever I have you on this show, Rod, listeners write in, viewers write in, and we're talking about you for years afterwards. I swear there's things you say, there's nuggets of truth, there's these amazing things you can just drop in the conversation and can kind of keep going often, Rod, that we come back to again and again and again in other conversations. With other guests, right? I think the one that I referenced most recently that you've said is the idea of that early church time machine, right? Plunk a early church father down into your church, and are they allowed to teach in that church? Will they say things that church doesn't accept? Or like that for me, I come back to that all the time, Rod, thinking about how we understand the early church and the contemporary churches, even amongst our own Catholic churches, how those that early church mindset would be received. So it's truth bombs like that, Rod, that you drop and you walk away and the carnage just follows behind and we're years just kind of unpacking.
I don't want to cause carnage for anybody. I do my thing and we'll see what happens. So.
It's good. It's all good carnage. The good kind. All right. So this episode is going to be very fun for me, Rod, and I hope that listeners will come along for the ride and enjoy this. And the genesis is this, and it's really, this is a true story, okay? Happened to a friend of mine who is a good evangelical friend who messaged me out of the blue the other day, much to his chagrin afterwards, because we then began to talk for a long, long time. And said to me, "Hey, I'm looking for a new church. Pray for me." And I said, "Okay," because he knows I'm a convert to Catholicism. We talk all the time about these kind of topics, and he's not. And so, of course, I responded with, "Well, here's the church for you. It's the Catholic Church." But I got thinking a bit further about this idea, this conversation, and your name came to mind, Rod, as somebody who's studied these kinds of things and written these kinds of things and done awesome work in this area. Because when someone says to me, "Okay, well, I'm looking for a new church," you know this, I know this. The evangelical, the Protestant mindset is we're looking for a church that suits us better, that holds to the Bible, you know, the best, that worships properly, that has things going on. But what I've learned over time, and I'm sure you have also grown to understand this too, is what we were looking for, Rod, was a church that matched what we thought the Bible taught, how we understood church should be. Because of course, when you try to interpret the Bible or the Bible, you're reading it through your lens. So the first problem for me in looking for a new church is, okay, how do I fix my lens in such a way that I'm not looking for a church that matches my view, but looking for a church that's the church, right? That's where the first problem arises. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, it's quintessentially American that we look for a church that tells us what we want to hear. That's the Nate, we do this with news networks, the whatever. We look for the one that tells it the way we like to hear it. Hopefully, if you have stepped a little bit outside of that, I mean, I think anybody who's listening to this program is expressed at least some small willingness to reassess or reevaluate some of their presuppositions. Then I think maybe many of you have moved to the next stage, which is, you know, shouldn't there be some connection between what I think of as a church and what Christ meant a church to be like, and how do I find that out?
Yeah.
I would submit, and in fact, I reached a point in my life where it became very, very obvious to me that the method of just opening up your Bible, doing your best to figure out what a church is supposed to look like, and then making one according to that model, it's very clear that that doesn't work. I mean, it became very, very obvious to me. I may have used this analogy before, but if you drive 10 miles to work in a day, you have passed 10 churches probably in most American cities. And all of us know that every one of them says that all in the world they did was just open up the Bible and see what it said to them. You know, let the Bible interpret itself. And yet we all know very well that they all got different answers. Sometimes we try to say, well, that was only about the lesser, smaller things, but it isn't. The soon as you get to these people together, you know, infant baptizing Presbyterians and Southern Baptists like I myself was at one point, you begin to realize that something you thought or were willing to consider a minor thing is pretty major indeed when the two of you get to going hammering tongs at it. So the idea, I think if we accept the idea that you wouldn't even be watching a program like this unless you were doing some reevaluating, then we have to ask, does Jesus have any idea, any way of creating church unity, doctrinal unity? Is he able to do that? I mean, we all say, well, okay, you can send the Holy Spirit and we'll all love each other. And presumably we've already tried that and we're still divided. We're still as divided as we could be. The churches that most insisted on the fact that all we needed was love, you know, back in the 19th century, when they all said, let's minimize all of these things we argue about and just love each other, are the churches that don't believe much of anything at all anymore. So all of those various methods seem to have failed. So I would say that the best question for the person that you're talking about is to say, does Jesus have a way? Is he able to create doctrinal unity in a church? Is that something he's capable of doing? And if it is, how does he express that? How does he do it? How does that work? In other words, does God have a plan for church unity? In other words, St. Paul, some people say the most obeyed verse in Scripture, the one we've done the best job of obeying, is back in Genesis, be fruitful and multiply. I would submit that the one we've done the poorest job of keeping is when Paul says, brethren, I want there to be no divisions amongst you. I want you all to say the same thing. I want you to be perfectly united in one mind and in one heart, and that you all say the same thing. That's the one that we've probably got the poorest batting average at. To such a degree that most people, when you kind of bring this point up, you throw up their hands and say, this is one of those verses that apparently can't be obeyed, that we don't understand what this is about. It's like the stuff in the Sermon on the Mount that can't possibly be meant literally. But it is. Look, the apostle meant it. And he gives it as a command. He says, I beseech you in the name of Christ. The apostle Paul beseeches us to all say the same thing. Has he given a command that's literally impossible to fulfill? You know, if not, then what was the plan for church unity? Church unity of the type that causes us all to say the same thing.
Yeah.
Okay, what was the plan? Was there a plan? And I think that would be the answer to the question. If you're looking for what church to join, start by looking at a church that has an answer to that question, that doesn't just say, well, I don't understand that, or we all just need to pray or whatever. Does God have a plan for church unity? And if so, what is it? And has it ever been expressed anywhere in world history? And does it work? I think those are excellent places to start with all of this.
I knew you were the guy to have on with this topic, Ron. I knew it. Already the truth is exploding in this episode, Ron. This is fantastic. That's a fantastic point. I love that. Because of course our Lord prays in John 17 for unity. Like, good golly, right? This is the last recorded prayer that Christ prays before ascending back to the Father. Right? It is for unity, and it's a very prophetic prayer. You know, may they be one as we are one, which of course is not a divided one of different denominations and different doctrinal beliefs. That's the closeness that can't be fathomed, right? In the Trinity, right? And so I remember for me in my experience, right, when I began to quote unquote look for a church in this exercise, right? I, like you say, I began looking closely at verses like John 17, like where Paul talks about also, right? This no divisions. And I began to say, well, how is this possible? Where does this happen? Why, Rod, would Paul give us a commandment that we cannot possibly follow?
Right.
Why would Jesus pray a prayer for us that can't possibly be fulfilled?
And has this ever worked? Has this ever worked?
Right. Right.
In other words, if things have always been the way they are now, if there's been division amongst groups and denominations and all the rest of it, and this is kind of supposed to be the way it is, then what was the point of all that? You know, it's interesting. John 17, Christ links it to the world's salvation. He says, Father, I am beseeching you to make us all one, even as you and I are one. Yeah. In other words, make the church and the Lord one, even as the Father and the Son are one. Well, what are the Father and the Son? What's their oneness like? They always say the same thing. There's no division amongst them. Okay. And he says, so that the world may know that you have sent me.
Yes.
The opposite of that is that if they don't see that unity, then they will conclude that the Father did not send Christ, which is pretty much what they have concluded. And we should expect that disunity is the major cause of the hardness of our evangelization efforts. In fact, I would say all of the problems that we have in the world right now, everybody thinks, oh, everything's going to the dogs and stuff. Well, our evangelization didn't work. Because if it had, we'd have a different country, a different world than we do now. Why didn't it work? Because we either disregarded this project of church unity, or we found answers we didn't like and got these others that we prefer better, or no answer at all. I reached a point as an evangelical that I had no answer at all, and I think most people have it. Well, we just pray. We love each other and we pray. Well, what are we praying for? Well, obviously, doctrinally, we're praying for all of those other churches out there to see it our way. In other words, we got it right. We're not reevaluating that. Okay. So what's the content of our prayer? Well, we'll sit here patiently and pray for everybody to realize that we've been right all along. We Presbyterians or Baptists or Methodists or whoever. And as soon as they get with the program, it'll be fixed, right? So it seems silly when you look at it this way, but that's the point I reached. Anyway, it is silly.
It is. And how often, I'm just trying to think as you're talking, Rod, how often do you see denominations actually getting back together again, or churches, they cleaved off one another, getting back together again? Like there is, in my understanding, no serious movement towards unity. And like you said before, no, the gestures that were made, I think up here in Canada, the United Church of Canada, that was kind of Presbyterian and Methodist and different, you know, different mainline groups uniting under one single kind of denomination. denomination, like you said before, that denomination now is a shell of Christianity, right? They hold very loosely to even the most fundamental tenets of
yeah,
of
that's Christianity. That's right. Nobody expected when we started doing this back in the 40s and 50s.
Yeah.
We said, well, we'll just reduce everything to a bare minimum.
Yeah.
In other words, we're going to make the project achievable. We're going to make success possible by narrowing it down as small as we can.
Yeah.
The doctrinal unity, well, this people joke and laugh about a bomb fog church. You remember the bomb fog churches? You remember this?
I don't know what you're talking about, Ron.
This is a B-O-M-F-O-G, bomb fog. This was a term that was used in mid-century.
I understand you were that old, Ron. I'm not quite.
Yes, bomb fog stands for Brotherhood of Man, Fatherhood of God. I don't know who coined it first, Henry Ward Beecher or somebody, I'm sure. So I'm not old enough to remember Henry Ward Beecher.
Fair enough.
He was a friend of Abraham Lincoln. But this was a term that was used in those mid-century ecumenical church unity movements that produced modern mainstream Protestantism. And who could have dreamed that eventually they couldn't even agree on the existence of God anymore?
Yeah.
In other words, they can't even get that simple, you know. They pass through Unitarianism to Universalism to, as far as I know now, there's absolutely nothing any of those churches have in common anymore, any more than the evangelicals do.
Yeah.
So the project of trying to succeed through reducing the size of the goal has not worked. And most evangelicals are not tempted by the World Council of Churches model anymore. I don't think anybody is anymore. It was a big hot thing when I was about 10, but it's the fact that it's patently failed is obvious to everybody at this point.
Yeah. And the other thing you mentioned there too, Rod, is the idea of, well, we agree on the essentials, right? So we might differ in how we worship on a Sunday or how we do our Bible studies or how we structure our church. We may have elders versus deacons or a board of directors or a steering committee or something, but we agree on the essentials. But of course, you know, you mentioned this, and of course you peel that layer back a little bit and you realize that, well, we don't. Because we can't agree on things that Scripture seems like we could argue are very, very clear. Like the Calvinists aren't going to agree with somebody who agrees, well, you can lose your salvation and it's a free choice.
And both sides on that are very, very serious about it too. Eternal security is not one of those things that it's okay to argue about or differ on.
Yeah.
Okay.
And even we're seeing breaks in Southern Baptists over women in leadership, right? These things that these churches held together for a long time and thought, okay, we agree on these things, these essentials. But what you call the essentials is a movable project. And
that's just as and much those, for me. You right? can argue about that just as much as you can any other piece of it. You know, which ones are essential and which one aren't. That's a whole new field of endeavor you opened up.
Yeah, it is. So, I guess the question is, and I guess the solution for me, and I've seen this before, and mostly my Anglican friends, is to go, well, the John 17 project, it did fail. We've moved past that. We're irreconcilably divided now. So let's make the best of it. Let's try the best to cling to the Bible and be a church that follows the Bible and do our best. But that this has failed and we can't get that back now. But I mean, the question for me, and I'll ask you in a second, Rod, what you think of this is, well, did Christ set up a system that he knew would fail? Like, does that make sense for the church that the bride of Christ that Christ establishes, that he knew that that would last for a certain number of years, decades if we're lucky, you know, of centuries if we're really lucky, and then fail? Like, that doesn't make any sense as a solution to say, oh, well, it failed. We'll carry on as best we can.
Well, you know, if you're the kind of person who's actually looking for a great apostasy, who really, really considers that an essential part of your system, that there was a prophesied great apostasy, then, you know, the fact that it should happen so very early on is pretty strange. But in reality, I would say that it does work and it has worked and it still works pretty good. God's original plan.
Yeah.
There is an original plan for church unity so that we would all say the same things. It doesn't work perfectly, okay, humanity being what it is, the piece of work that it is, and the large, you know, the all of us, you know, still got a big unregenerate chunk in us that that fights against it every day. But this is what I'm about to say is not a commercial for Roman Catholicism. I'm going to say this in a way that's maybe a little different than you expect to hear. And that is that, and I don't know, I may have mentioned this on the program before, I don't know. But I, about 85% of the church is still doctrinally unified today. Protestant evangelicalism and other forms of Protestant make a big noise in North America. But, and they give the impression that this is Christianity, okay? But if you take the world's Roman Catholics, the Eastern Orthodox churches, and you can even bring in the traditional Anglicans, Coptics, the Copts, and things like that. If you bring in all of those people who still have preserved the apostolic form of church government, bishops, priests, and deacons, with the idea that there's an apostolic succession and that you pass down the sacred tradition of how to do all of this, how to work this these doctrinal issues out. You've got an 85% church unity, okay? Now, does that mean that the individual members are all believers, full believers in the program? You know, most of us know that the human heart's too wayward for that. But we will say that to have, if you remove the very top tier of doctrine about what to do when the bishops disagree with each other, for example, you know, what when the Bishop of Rome and the Bishop of Constantinople disagree, what happens? Okay, let's remove that very top tier of issues, which is maybe the top 2% of the faith. Okay, all right, let's just remove that from the discussion for a minute. Then all of these other churches, if you take that, and surely the governmental issues are the least vital for the ordinary layperson like me and you, not to minimize them, but those churches that I listed, they all have the Catholic faith of the early church fathers. They still have it enshrined on the books, so to speak. They sometimes, and in some eras and some places, they do a better job keeping it than others. But about 85% of the world's Christians are members of churches that have the Catholic faith as their official teaching. They've got it enshrined in their creeds and articles and on the books, so to speak. The individual members are challenged to keep it more and more every day. But the issue of whether the church itself, speaking for most of its members, says the same thing, the answer is yes, they do. And the you know, there are a few divisive issues at the very top, most related to church government. In fact, I would say that even the ones that divide the Eastern Orthodox from the Roman churches, the theological issues involved really are about the papacy. You know, they all are divisive because the Pope had some important role in setting them up as authoritative. So even that, in a way, is has something to do with church government. So that Catholic faith, that's an encouraging thought, as Gandalf once said. The fact that 85% of the world's Christians are committed in writing to the original Catholic faith that's the same that as Augustine held and Irenaeus and all the rest all the way back to the beginning is really important. In other words, the very premise of the argument that we look around and it's impossible to believe that God ever had any plan for church unity of the type where you all say the same thing. Actually, it's kind of impossible not to see it. You know, the churches where it gets real impossible to see are the ones that say we just opened up our Bible and did what we found there. The ones that say we kept the Catholic traditions passed down to us from the apostles get it right 9 times out of 10, at least. You know, they agree 9 times out of 10, at least. So, so that's my my pitch, and like I say, it's I'm not insisting that you get the final 5% right in the Catholic way to get to understand this argument. In other words, if you move to being a Coptic Christian or an Eastern Orthodox or something, or join some traditional Anglican church in Uganda or someplace like that, you will find that you believe the Catholic faith and you have no problem with the stuff that's in the early church fathers. It comes as natural as falling off the bed. So not only did God have a plan for church unity, which is called apostolicity, that that hands were laid on approved ministers and through the ages they passed down the original faith, apostolic faith, the Catholic faith of one church for everybody. Even if it's imperfectly kept, they're still an enormous visible sign of most of the world's Christians by far when called upon to answer, give their church's answer to the questions of theology. They all say the same things, just as Paul enjoined us to do. So,
well, that's a fascinating observation, Rod. And I love that because, of course, in North America, where we are here, like you say, we're seeing kind of through a glass darkly. We're seeing kind of things distorted a bit because of the evangelical influence in North American Christianity, right? That distorts things a bit. When we look around and say, well, of course, how could there ever be unity here? There's no way we can open our Bible and be united in the way that it seems like we should be. This project doesn't quite work. It failed at some point. Something went wrong. These guys here aren't reading their Bible in the right way like we are, right? Is often kind of the mentality. Or I think too, Rod, just not to realize that paradigm that you are in, right? We're steeped in this. And I think for you and me, this might have been a similar kind of recognition. You know, you're steeped in a paradigm that you don't necessarily realize that what you're doing is a modern invention of Christianity. It's a modern way of doing Christianity that's only but 500 years old. And before that, you wouldn't have just gone to, you know, a bookstore and bought a Bible and opened it and read it and found a church that kind of matched your reading of the Bible. That's an innovation.
Yeah, maybe so.
Yeah. And I think in large part, it's not necessarily going, okay, this is not a possible thing to do. Look at these denominations. We can't possibly be united. It's maybe more often than not just swimming in the water of that paradigm. You don't even realize that you're finding a church. You know, my friends went out and finding a church based on a paradigm that's very, very new that says, you know, this is how I find a church. And it says there's no one United Church here that I could possibly ever join, missing, as you say, that 85% that all hold very close doctrinal unity, right? I mean, that's a really interesting thought experiment, thing to think through. If you are looking for a church, maybe the paradigm through which you're looking for that church is itself not the paradigm that maybe Christ would have.
Well, maybe the way to say it is, I don't mean to make it sound foolish. Maybe the way to say it is that if you find that the people in the evangelical way of doing things are very, very divided, and you find that they're more divided than most types of Christians are, at least doctrinally speaking, keep in mind, we're talking about doctrine. I should introduce a caveat here. I would have been looking for a chance to do this. Sometimes when people hear a discussion like this, they think that you are saying, come over and join the Catholic Church. It's a better church. The people are holier and happier, and you will have a closer walk with God, et cetera, if you come and join this church. I'm old enough and have been around enough to know that no church, any church, has cornered the market on virtue. And in fact, I have found that real human sanctity is about equally rare in every communion. I think this is not to say that doctrinal unity doesn't matter. It's just simply to say that I'm not pitching our church as a place where you will come and have a better time than you've had in your previous churches, or you will feel closer to God. You know, the some of the stumbling blocks are removed, so there is an opportunity to get closer to God. But that's not, you know, again, this is the disclaimer. I'm not telling you come and find a better class of Christians over here in Rome. I think it was Cardinal Newman. I found this interesting Cardinal Newman quote the other day. This was after he'd been a cardinal in the Catholic Church for some years, convert from Anglicanism. He said, I look back and I see that when my, he said that as a Protestant, my, He said that when he was a Protestant, his religion was confusing and dull, but his life was exciting and rewarding. He said when he came into the Catholic Church, he encountered all kinds of suppression by many of the Catholic bishops. He found that he'd taken on his shoulders a much greater load of distrust and other things like that. It has something to do with the fact that an important clergyman from a Protestant church was a rarer animal than he is now. So he said, I have found that my life was more exciting as a Protestant. My faith is more exciting now than it was, but my life was more exciting back then. And so anyway, all that just simply to provide the disclaimer. I know that sometimes when we do these apologetic shows, it seems like we're offering a, why don't you come over and get with the program and then all your troubles will be over. And Lord, no. But so we're not talking about that. We're asking the question, what did Paul mean for us to do when he said, I beseech you in the name of Jesus to always say the same thing, that there be no divisions among you. And we know that that it's not unity. I remember one time going down a highway and seeing a sign on a Methodist church that said, unity is unity of heart, not unity of mind. And I said, that's a nice thought, but there's no biblical basis for that. The Apostle Paul says, yes, have unity of heart or you never will progress towards God. Okay. But if you don't have unity of mind, your message is going to be discordant. You're going to make no headway with your evangelization because your message is a mess and it's chaotic and not believable, as he predicted that it wouldn't be. The world will know if you're unified with the same kind of unity that Father and Son have. The Father and the Son always say the same thing.
Well, then you mentioned too, and this is again a fascinating thing, right? So if this is possible, your search for a church should then for sure be first kind of look, okay, so what church is unified like Christ prayed for, like Paul commanded us to be unified, and what church has the mechanism to do that? And I think this is now when we dig down a bit deeper, because this is a really fascinating thing, right? We've, I think, identified at least a little bit, at least. And I guess, you know, you could push deeper as a Protestant, maybe throw some curveballs in here about how the Bible could be that unifying factor. I would attest, I've tried pretty hard, lots of guests on this show, yourself included, Rod, have tried pretty hard to use the Bible as a unifying source. And that has seemed to have failed as a project for honest and earnest Christians.
Right.
So, there must be then, you know, that project, that looking for that church must then expand to, okay, so what churches have a mechanism to be united? And of course, this is what Joe Heschmeyer from Catholic Answers calls the most distinctive doctrine of the Catholic Church. And I think it's in the papacy that there is that ability for ultimate unity, like it would seem like Christ intended. Does that make sense to you?
Right. Well, it does. Again, with my 85% analogy, I don't know if it's an analogy or what it is, but I was not going to that final step. We could do that. It seems to me that the arguments for the papacy are, if you want to get across the finish line for that 5% that I allowed was still disunified amongst the Catholic with the small C churches, the churches that still hold the faith of the fathers, minus one or two of those points and stuff. I would say if you were looking for a church, one of those churches is the place to start. because you will certainly be a lot further down the road towards doctrinal unity, towards always saying the same thing as 85% of the other Christians do. If you just examine Eastern Orthodoxy, and I'm not even here to say you need to go beyond that. Obviously, I have an answer that I would offer if you wanted to go beyond that. Okay. But it's not necessary to understand this argument that apostolicity, the idea of sacred tradition passed down through the apostolic succession, has produced visible unity, doctrinal unity. That's all that's necessary for this argument. I absolutely second, obviously, the idea that let's get people across the goal line with the papacy. But I would just say for now, it's that the power of what I'm saying is based on the idea that you needn't go quite that far. You still get 95% of the job done, and everybody knows the evangelicals don't have hardly any of it done. And it's not a moral thing, not because we're smarter than they are or because they're, morally not together like us, goodness knows, but simply that, if you find that your rule of faith, as the early fathers used to call it, what is your rule of faith? You know, basically, what is your method for arriving at the doctrine, scriptural doctrine? What's your method for parsing out what is and isn't a command from God, your rule of faith? If your rule of faith is producing chaotic results, it's a good idea to go back and look and see if you missed a step somewhere, you know? And that's what we're offering here. We're saying, look at the churches that claim to have passed their Catholic religion down through the ages, and that they still say the same things that they said in the 16th century, the 10th century, the 6th century, the 1st century. It can be done. In other words, I'm here to tell you as somebody who has read deeply in the early writings that it can be done. It's not an impossible task. And that you can show that those churches, you know, if we quarreled with the Eastern churches in the 11th century, well, we quarreled over a small range of issues, because if you get their catechism from that period and ours together, it's the same. If you say, and the same through all of this, whereas you can't say that about any of the other churches that are formed with the evangelical rule of faith. You just go to the Bible and let it interpret itself. That plainly doesn't work.
Yeah.
And there's to the point that there's no point in talking about it anymore. If you can't see that, then God bless you. this show's not for you. But if you can see that the evangelical churches are not all saying the same thing, they're not perfectly united in one mind, as the apostles enjoined them to be. So if you're willing to go back and question your rule of faith and say, maybe I missed a step, maybe I should, this thing, this mechanism that has supposedly provided 85% doctrinal unity, maybe I ought to look at that. Maybe I ought to investigate that and see how that happened and whether that can really be true.
Yeah,
because it's pretty nice to say, you know, the church is not hopelessly disunified. It's not. Most of it is still doctrinally united. You know, there's 15%, you know. So mostly the job's done. So this job of saying, oh my God, how could you ever have this unity? It's mostly finished, doctrinally speaking.
Yeah.
Orthodoxy. And now we got to all work on orthopraxis.
Absolutely. And I don't want to push it too hard, because we're friends, Ron. But you know, the interesting thing is that, you know, since the different schisms amongst those churches that hold to the apostolic tradition, right, between the Eastern Orthodox Church, Coptic Church, Ethiopian Orthodox Church, since those splits have happened, there have been concerted efforts among all sides to try and find places of overlap, right? Even in recent days, you know, the Pope has been historically celebrating different liturgies or allowing liturgies to take place within the Vatican and going other places, not the Vatican proper, but you know, within Catholic churches working on celebrating liturgies together and making inroads to find ways to unite more closely, right? So it is an ongoing project to restore those
union. We're still looking for a more perfect union in the language of our American documents.
Yes,
it's an ongoing process.
Yeah, you'd go there, Rod, for sure. Yeah. quoting your American documents. But these movements don't exist, right, in Protestant churches. There's movements to disunity, away from, you know, the splits upon splits. And there is not the 30,000 denominations that are thrown around. That number is, as far as I can tell, and good apologists have figured this out, that number does not exist anywhere. That's a made-up number that we shouldn't be using.
The word hundreds is pretty safe.
Yeah.
The word hundreds is pretty safe.
But I think you said this, I think, on the show one time, Rod. If there's more than a few, that's too many. That's too many, right?
Because
there shouldn't be. So at least if that 85% isn't fully united and 100% on all the doctrines, right, there are active movements, and there have been since shortly after these things happened, to come back together in ways and find unity in ways that we can, that those groups can, right? So that's at least an important movement. I would put pressure upon you a little bit to say, not making you say this, but I'll say this, that distinctly the one thing that I think, and someone again, like there's plenty of authors out there who've written fantastic books on the papacy, the thing that can go a long way to unite the apostolic churches and any Christian who wants to be united is the fact that, okay, it seems like Christ established a church with somebody at the head, you know, the head of the apostles, and the bishops, that succession passed on, the Orthodox Church maintains that line, the Coptic Church maintains that line, those churches have those bishops. The one thing, though, that seems like would be the ultimate unifying factor is unity around, you know, the chair of Peter, right? The papacy, right, that it seems like we can trace back that Christ established. This seems to be the ultimate mechanism for ensuring unity. The Pope in union with the bishops, which ultimately seems like it would be the answer to, well, how is this done, right? That goes that one step further. Right? The 85%.
Oh, no. You may be misunderstanding me. In other words, this is an apologetic.
I know. I understand.
This is an apologetic thought experiment. I'm not saying we can do just as well without the papacy and all the rest of it. It's so important these days. People have been spun so often. They've had so many commercials, you know, that if you tell people, if you'll just join the Catholic Church and do whatever the Pope tells you, everything will be all right. Well, I dare say it wouldn't be, but maybe there's maybe you don't have to go quite that far just yet. You know, let's encounter you in the early stages and meet you halfway there.
Yeah.
But obviously, I second everything you're saying about the nature of the papacy, and I hope that in thoughtful inquirers will get to that sooner rather than later. But it needn't be done first, is what I'm saying. You can encounter the Catholic faith without necessarily encountering all of it at once.
I'm not trying to be the inquisitor. Rod.
Makes the show more interesting when you're not just flattering me, when you're arguing with me a little bit. That makes it more interesting.
Okay. Yeah. Now I know. So,
absolutely.
So you're looking for a church, okay? You say, okay, I want to find a church that sounds like what Christ was looking for, a united church that has some way of being united. Where does this exist? You're beginning to see, okay, there's this apostolic kind of churches that seem to exist. Right. One of the questions that I know you asked, and I began to ask, and we're both kind of floored by this question, was, well, okay, so what would this church look like? It would have some mechanism for being united. It would have a faith kind of being passed on through laying of hands that we can kind of trace back. But you begin to encounter, and you know, I read from the early church fathers and discovered that we can actually see what that first church would look like. Ergo, a church that exists today that we're looking for should look a lot like that church, right? And then the realization, you know, for you and for me, Rod, was, well, my church doesn't look like this. Nothing like this in terms of the structure and the way we worshiped and the way we encountered, you know, Christ and understood that mission and heck, baptized people like right. these kinds of things. Right. The next, I think, realization is, well, okay, I'm looking for a church. How do I know what kind of church to look for? And by golly, there's places you can look to see what that church might look like. Right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that was, it was helpful to me. The fathers were what did it. In other words, if you go back and, you know, if your idea is that all of these things like baptismal regeneration and prayers to Mary and the papacy and all of that are like barnacles that attach themselves to the ship through the ages. I think it was Luther who first made this analogy, that these are things that collected on the ship, on this ship that didn't really belong there, and that the best thing to do is scrape them off. You know, if you find that they are there right away, if you find baptismal regeneration in a man who was probably baptized by Peter, and if you find bishops and priests and deacons being laid out in no uncertain terms as the way real churches are structured, Ignatius of Antioch is whom I'm thinking of, and you find that he was a man who knew the Apostle John and personally and labored in his vineyard, then you've got new questions about these so-called barnacles. You have to change your opinion. You don't have to accept them because of that. It is possible that the church went off the rails before the apostles were cold yet, you know. That's possible, I suppose. Okay, and I'm not even going to offer arguments about the probability of such a thing. I'm not offering you this as an argument for you need to, it's because it's really old, you need to do it this way too. I'm just saying that the barnacle theory doesn't work anymore. Yeah. You have to go to some other theory, which the more sophisticated responses to this argument try to do. They say, okay, well, we don't say that there were no prayers to Mary in 250 AD because there's one in the British Museum. We don't say that anymore. What we do say is there was different strains, that the church was already very divided right away, and that one of those strains looked a little bit like modern Catholicism, but there were the other strains too, and there was a real good Baptist strain too early on there. And so what happened is later on, you know, maybe at Constantine's conversion, he took that Catholic strain that went off the rails right away, and he made that the main one and then promoted that and sponsored it and all the rest of it, and persecuted the evangelical strain. Well, you have a conspiracy theory there. Okay, there's not, the evidence doesn't support this idea. And many people do consciously have a conspiracy theory about that. They say, well, the records of early evangelicalism, all those early non-forms of non-Catholic Christianity, the Catholics got in charge later and they wiped them all out. It isn't true. All the Marcionite books and Montanist books and Arian books and Gnostic books, the whole world is still got them. You can go to your library today, you can look online and read the whole Nag Hammadi library, which is all Gnostic scriptures from the second century and all the rest of it. All of the non-Catholic Christianity is still preserved. The records are still there. Nobody wiped them out. What it is that if you're looking for evangelicalism, you won't find them, because the Gnostics and the Marcionites and these other groups that I listed are even weirder than Catholicism from the evangelical perspective. You believe me, you will feel much more at home with the Catholics than you will with any of the groups whose heretical writings are still in existence. So most people don't have the stomach for quite such a thoroughgoing conspiracy theory that Constantine found all the early Presbyterians and silenced them, you know. So, but it can be done. But most, I wouldn't suggest it.
And I love that. Then, so right, the experiment becomes, okay, so if Christ founded a church that was unified, that had this kind of succession, that had these different things, we can find that We can find that from the earliest sources, right? From people, as you say, who are probably baptized by Peter himself in that crowd, sounding like, you know, and having things like bishops and priests and deacons and believing that baptism actually saves, and talking about the Eucharist as actually the flesh and blood of Christ, and these, you know, a very liturgical kind of worship, hierarchical structure. I think of, you know, Jerome talks about the mono episcopate. So the idea that one bishop was in charge of one kind of area, one diocese. He talks about it being as widespread as in Rome and also in Alexandria. So, you know, across the known world, very shortly after the apostles, this framework began of a hierarchical church, right? That really flies in the face of a lot of the landscape of churches you might see if you're looking in Protestant Christianity. And then the experiment becomes, okay, well, yeah, that was fine, but those things were added on to it later on, right? And, you know, that experiment is, well, look back as far as we can go. And if those things already exist there, well, they weren't added on. So, okay,
and
so...
The other things don't exist. The churches, yeah. Even those crazy groups I mentioned, the Arians and the Montanists, they had bishops, priests, and deacons. They had baptism of the Catholic variety, all the rest of it. They were, even the weird splinter groups looked a lot more Catholic than most people are happy about.
Right.
In today's evangelical circle,
right. So that then becomes a question. I think you have to ask if you're looking for a church. Now, this was a challenge put to me one time, actually, by a marriage therapist. My wife and I were seeing when I was on my road to conversion. We hired and paid way too much for a therapist that ended up just kind of being a guy who just kind of grilled me on my Catholic conversion ideas. That's a long story and required other therapy of other sorts after that therapy for the therapy we went to. But his question, Rod, was, okay, well, why is older better? Why, if you're looking for a church, why is a church that's older going to be necessarily be better? But I think the response, and I think you've already given this, is it's not about being older. It's about being that church that continues like that way all through the ages, I think, right? Yeah. We're not just following an old church for the sake of it, right?
The way to frame the question is, did God have a plan for church unity?
Yeah, yeah.
If not, then he intends the mess that we're in now, okay? But if he has a plan for church unity, there ought to be some evidence preserved for it. You know, like you go back in the fossils and the rocks and look for evidence for an asteroid strike that happened at a certain era, not before or not later. If God has a plan for church unity, it's significant that it works pretty well. That for the first 1,000 years, no church that a evangelical would recognize as Orthodox was split or separate from the Catholic Church. Yes, there were splinter groups, but they were groups that even evangelicals would consider grossly heretical. You know, that's 1,000 years. You find these splinter groups and they're teaching that Montanus is the incarnation of the Holy Spirit or whatever. You know, yes, there are splinter groups, but you wouldn't want to have anything to do with them. And so what kind of church kept saying the same thing for 1,000 years? I pick 1,000 years because that predates the East-West split, yeah. Catholic Orthodox. Yeah. The church was unified. The church said the same thing, okay? What kind of church is that and how did it do it? That's why old is better, because if you can see that the church taught one thing in, you know, 50 AD and 150 AD and 500 AD, and they kept teaching the same thing up until some division started happening in the second millennium, then there's evidence there that God did have a plan for church unity. And if that's true, then old matters, you know. It doesn't matter because it's old. It matters because it's a clue to what the teachings of Christ really are. Presumably, we ought to care about that, you know. Finding out what the authentic teaching of Christ is, you know. I mean, most of the time we settle for something we can get comfortable with,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
But to look for that thing that makes us uncomfortable because we're testing our rule of faith that we talked about matters. I got another old new analogy that might help on this point. It's related. I call this one day I'm going to write this as a book, The Argument from Collapse. And I'll warn our Protestant viewers that it sounds more offensive maybe than I mean it to be. I promise I'm not trying to be deliberately offensive. I think you'll see my point.
Very cordial of you.
I want to go around and collect doctrinal statements about moral issues, okay? The Christian teachings on morality, Christian behavior, Christian morals, okay? I want to get a doctrinal statement from every church today in 2023, and then I want to go back and get the same churches to give me their historical preserved doctrinal moral statements from 1923, 100 years, okay? And we're going to ask about divorce and remarriage. We're going, because they're all there in their moral statements, divorce and remarriage, abortion, birth control, all of these other things, right down to, modern issues about sex outside of marriage and whether homo or hetero, et cetera, et cetera. And we're going to get all of those statements. And what you're going to get, and I've done some of this already, those old doctrinal statements are hard to get. If they don't teach them anymore, they hide them. Okay. no offense, but they're buried deeply in old libraries. Yeah, The Baptist Faith and Message from 1923 is going to be, you're going to have a job of work digging that up. But if you look at those things, what you're going to find is, and I'll say this from the conclusion that I reached at the end of having done an incomplete version of this, you're going to be able to say, as a Catholic, you're going to say, look, guys, not only do we still, in the Catholic Church, still say what you used to say on this stuff, not, we still say what we used to say, yes. In other words, the Catholic teachings on this are the same. They haven't changed. Keep in mind, on the books, in practice, there's any amount of falling away on the part of ordinary people who were all like sheep who've gone astray, you know. But you look at it and you say, not only does our church still say the things we used to say, we still say what you used to say.
Wow.
And that matters. That's important. There's an argument there. The argument is if 90% of the other churches no longer say, can look at their 1923 statement and affirm it, and we can, that says something. It may mean that we're calcified and a bunch of celibate old men are controlling everything. Maybe. That's one possible answer. But another possible answer, especially for evangelicals who like to think of themselves as moral conservatives, and I'm glad that they do, it matters that your church used to teach against remarriage and doesn't anymore. It matters that your church used to teach against birth control, artificial birth control, and doesn't anymore. Okay. The first Protestant church that ever started teaching, accepting artificial birth control was the Anglican Church in 1930. Okay. So 1923 is on the other side of that. So, and again, I say this not to throw some sort of slap in your face, but to say that old matters, because if you go back and you find a church that still says what it says 100 years ago, when none of the others do, you've encountered a factoid. You've got something you need to put in your pipe and smoke. If you see what I'm saying, you need to stew that over.
Oh,
yeah. It matters.
These are why we invite you back again and again. You drop these bombs, you walk away, you leave us just flabbergasted for years afterwards in your wake, Rod. That's a fantastic challenge, because of course, like these churches, right? And I'd be curious too, because the ones that are newer than 1923, I mean, that in and of itself kind of begs a question, right? If that church can't trace itself back 100 years. Well, then that in and of itself is a kind of a question mark. Well, how do we understand that factoid then, right? But the ones that can trace that far back, they're, I think, and this is the paradigm thing, because you're in the paradigm that you kind of assume, I'm in this church that teaches from the Bible, so of course it's taught the same thing for forever, because the Bible hasn't changed, right? And this experiment is fantastic, because of course it illuminates the fact that, well, if the Bible hasn't changed, how come our thinking on these things have changed? What's caused that to change? Right? Mm-hmm. I think that's such an interesting thought experiment, right? If you are looking for a church, you know, a new church, okay, you're joining a Bible-based church, but has that church been based on the same understanding of the Bible for its existence? That's a big thing worth considering, Rod. I love that.
It's fine if you think the changes have been for the better. That's fine. Most people probably do and stuff. But the fact that the change had to be made.
Yeah.
Why? Wow. And that elsewhere, meaning in the churches that have kept the Catholic faith, it's still in line. We can go back to the much earlier than 1923. We can go back to 1023 and 523, and it's still the same message when it comes to the issues we're talking about.
Yeah, Rod, I once had an interaction on Twitter. Of course, this is already like that. That statement just tells you now that I shouldn't have done this, because whoever has good interactions on Twitter with somebody who was talking about abortion, and they said, oh, the Catholic Church just recently invented this doctrine as kind of a reaction to different things happening kind of in the world. And I thought for half a second, and as a good, you know, patristic, loving Catholic, like loving the early church fathers, thought of, well, actually, like in one of the earliest documents we have, the Didache, abortion is explicitly condemned in the the earliest document we have.
Might date from 70 AD.
Yeah.
And interestingly, it is quite a bit more explicit than any passage in the New Testament about it.
Yes. So I thought, you know, On things like that, right? We have the Catholic Church has this continuous history since the absolute earliest beginning of the Catholic Church, speaking on some of these issues that other churches have, you know, since in the last 100 years changed their ideas on, right? But the Catholic
Church, it's a lot to say hooray for us.
Yeah,
it's just simply to say it's a fact. It is a factoid. Yeah. You need to consider it. Yes. You need to think about how it happened, and does it matter?
Yeah.
And what does it say about history?
Yeah. And maybe, like you said, there are a bunch of calcified old celibate men leading the church, and it's not a good thing we haven't changed that. But it has to be considered. Why didn't it change? Why did others change? Right? That question has to be asked. No matter what the answer, we should change.
That's still a good question. Why has it lasted so long?
Yeah.
You know, people have been prophesying the end of the Catholic Church over and over again for 2,000 years, and not only does it not fail, but it also still says the same thing.
Yeah, I think that's fantastic. Okay, one more thing, and then I got to leave because I don't want to keep you all up all night long. I know you got to get to bed. You're getting up up in the years, Rod. You need your sleep. You need your good.
I went there.
The idea that and this is again the paradigm that many people who are looking for a new church are going to inherit if they're in the Protestant stream of things, right, in North America especially, is the idea that the Reformation restored something that was broken way back when, right? Maybe the early church looks great somewhere along the line, whether it's at Constantine or later on, the church kind of fell into a thing that was beyond saving. There was nothing else there that could be saved. Yeah, Christ founded it. We messed it up. The Reformation reestablished that. So we should be Protestant because that's the best of Christianity and the best way to be Christian now. I mean, we've gone through objections to this already, unity around the Bible, these different things. But is there something to be said for a person that has that mindset, that maybe just inherits that mindset, that of course we've got to be Protestant. The Catholic thing failed. This is what we have now. We'll make the best of it. Is there a response to that mindset to kind of shake you up a little bit, to make you reconsider something more deeply? What do you think?
Well, I guess I would ask, point to things that the Reformation succeeded in reforming.
Yeah, okay.
The only thing is, if just getting rid of the Pope and the Catholic Church is reform, then I'll grant you that one. Okay, if that's all it is. We no longer have to endure that degrading slavery. If that's all there is, then yeah, it reformed that. Okay. But what else? Did it make the clergy more holy? No. Even Luther admitted that that the morals of the clergy was worse after the Reformation than before. he regretted it, you know. Did it make the people more orthodox? Even Luther admitted that Germany was worse off, that he said the Bible has become a heresy book. And this was 25 years after the Reformation. There's no peasant so rude that thinks that he can't open up the German Bible and start a new religion. So, and Luther, God bless him, didn't expect this. He thought when everybody opened the Bible in German, it was just the light bulbs would go off and everybody'd see it the same way. Everybody'd say the same thing. And he found out that that wasn't the truth. He said, you know, that, and all the rest of them. In other words, Luther, if he was supposed to reform the Mass, well, he didn't get rid of transubstantiation. He called it a different word. But everything that most evangelicals dislike about transubstantiation, Luther kept. Real presence of Christ in the Eucharist, a real transformation happens, a spiritual miracle, all the rest of it. Luther baptized infants. Luther did all the other things. If these were things that needed reforming, then Luther didn't reform them. He kept them. But you got a different list of things you wanted reformed, right? Well, everybody does. So the question is, what is something that the Reformation unambiguously reformed so that all Protestants would agree was a reformation? And the only thing that you can come up with, if you look at it historically, is it got the horrible Catholic Church out of Northern Europe. And if that's reform, then you're right. It reformed that. So,
yeah. And I guess the one thing that, and this for me comes back to David Andrews, who's a fantastic, I think near your neck of the woods, actually, I think, Rod, David Andrews is Alabama, maybe? I don't know. Is that close to where you are?
Sort of.
I'm Canadian. I don't know what. I don't know where you live, Rod. Yeah. I think
parts of Alabama can be 400 miles from where I am. So,
wait, where are you? The moon? I think it was him that, you know, he's of course a convert to Catholicism. He's a Lutheran, a scholar of Calvin, and he kind of talks about the idea that, okay, the one thing that we often perceive the Reformation as doing is freeing the Bible from the clutches of the evil Catholic Church, right? It was literally chained to churches so that the average Christian couldn't read it. And, of course, the pushback, Rod, we know is, well, yeah, it was chained so nobody would steal it, first of all. And it was read.
One handwritten copy of the Bible was worth about enough to buy a Lexus.
Yeah. So it was.
To keep people from stealing them, you had to chain them up. Yeah, they didn't do it just with the Bible. They did it with science books and poetry and Dante and all the rest of it.
Yeah, it wasn't chained to keep the Bible out of the hands of people. It was chained that people had access to the Bible to hear the Bible. Because, of course, the other part of that is they couldn't read. So it was chained in the church so that somebody who could read it to them.
Exactly right.
So that, so you know, the one pushback that I think many... You know, I certainly would have said this as an evangelical. One good thing the Reformation did, Rod, was free the Bible out of the hands of the church and unchain it quite literally and given it to the masses. But that of course, is prejudiced on an understanding that's not quite accurate about what the Bible was doing there and who could have it once it was freed, who could actually read it and understand it, right?
For example... It's a simple historical fact that the King James Bible that's so revered by English-speaking Protestants, myself included in many ways, it's a good translation, especially the Revised Version, is also correctly charged with being largely a bit of plagiarism from the Douay-Rheims Bible, of a few years earlier, the Catholic Douay Bible that was made very early at the beginning of the Reformation. The King James comes a few years later. So if the Bible was freed, if Protestants freed the Bible from the evil Catholic Church, why did they copy it pretty much straight out from a Catholic Bible?
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, and why it's just mythology. Yeah. People historically need to understand how passionate the British were to establish a new political order that was not that had a church that was not going to give them any commands.
Yeah.
So as a result, it was really important to explain why we threw off the real England had been Catholic for 700 years. It was really important to explain to people why we were not doing that anymore. So there were a lot of mythology was allowed to get around. And, you know, but anyway, that's a whole other topic for a different episode. I think.
Well, Rod, this topic has been amazing. It's always a pleasure to have you on the show. And I hope that, you know, that my good friend who's looking for a church, Rod, that this is some fodder for him to consider, to think deeply about. These are challenging challenges. Yeah, that's good, eh?
As opposed to the ones that aren't challenging.
No, the easy challenges. Yeah, easy. Oh, easy. Yeah, right. Yeah, this is hardcore mode. This is no easy mode here, Rod. This is good. This is good stuff to think through, I think, for anybody who's asking these questions, right? These are really important questions to ask that I think shift some paradigms, begin to kind of maybe poke holes in assumptions you may have had or maybe carrying, and force a person to look at the church writ large through, I think, I hope, new lenses, Rod. So I appreciate this. Hopefully, listeners, yeah, I know, will love this. My friend's going to hate me for doing this episode, I think, Rod, because you're going to make him do a little bit more work than I think he was hoping for.
I was just telling my son the other day, I told him, Jack, I said, I really wish that we had an English term or an English phrase that sounds nicer than, I wish there was a nice way to say, friend, you don't know what you're talking about. But there is none. Sometimes you have to be told that you should stop and read this book and this book and this book because you don't know what you're talking about. There's no way to say that without offending, though. I should, many times I can look back on where I had had a discussion where I defended some position and I didn't know what I was talking about. I had developed a strong conviction about something that I hadn't studied carefully. And I needed to go back and read this and this and this, and then come back and we'll talk. So, so that's what I want to tell our friends. I wish there were a nice way to tell you that you don't know what you're talking about on this subject of the early church. Oh, that's what I needed to be told when I was an evangelical. Yeah. You have ideas about what the early church was like. I'm sure you came by them honestly, but Rod, you just don't know what you're talking about. When somebody tells you that and you accept it, they've done you a great service, but it is hard to take, I'll concede. And like I say, we'll keep looking for a nicer way to get across the idea that you don't know what you're talking about, because Lord, we need one.
That's fantastic, Rod. Always a pleasure to have you on the show. Listen, I'll put links to all of your fantastic books in the show notes for this show. And anywhere else you want to point people towards to find and follow your stuff? I mentioned the Popcorn Cathedral. That's a hoot and a half. I don't know if you want more viewers checking that out, but I'll put links to whatever you want. It's
not apologetics. The idea is, well, C.S. Lewis once said, the world doesn't need more little books about Christianity. It needs more books on other subjects with the Christianity latent. So Popcorn Cathedral is a... Jack and I are movie buffs. We're geeky. And so we go on. We've started a podcast about talking about geeky stuff from a Christian way. So that's what the Popcorn Cathedral is. If you're interested in joining us, just look up Popcorn Cathedral on YouTube. That's where we are.
That's fantastic stuff. I'll put links to that in the show notes as well for this show, Rod. It's a lot of fun. I want to say thank you for being here again, Rod. 4 years going strong. You come on, you drop these truth bombs, you walk away and leave us just smarting for years. So thank you for that. I'll be tuned on this for a while, Rod. I know listeners will as well. I want to say God bless you and the fantastic work you are doing for the church. Thank you, Rod.
You too.
And thanks. Thanks for being here.
Okay, take care. So long, everybody.
Ha ha ha. I don't know about you guys, but Ron is one of my favorite people to talk to on this show. Such a hoot. One of the guys that when I reached out way back when, 4 years ago, as an absolute newbie podcaster, he was happy as anything to be on the show and talk way back then. And since then, carried on this beautiful tradition of coming on the show, dropping these truth bombs, and walking away. It's the Rod Bennett way, and it's absolutely fabulous. Hopefully you loved that. Giving you, I hope, and people you might encounter and talk to and wrestle with alongside questions like this, really some awesome food for thought, some really good fodder to dig through. I think it's fantastic. TheCordialCatholic.com is our website for show notes for this show and others, and my blog, CordialCatholic@gmail.com, for your feedback. Let me know if you have any questions, comments, ideas, insights. Please email those my way. I have tons of emails, so I get back to those as soon as I can, but I do go through those, so please do send off your emails that way. We're on TikTok, Instagram, and Twitter @CordialCatholic, TheCordialCatholic on Facebook, and to watch what you're listening to, head over to YouTube.com/TheCordialCatholic, and please, when you're there, subscribe to that channel, and please do so to help it keep going and growing there as well. Links are in the show notes if you want to support this show financially through Patreon or through PayPal. Those links are in the show notes, and thanks to those already supporting the show week after week. Thanks, guys. Ratings and reviews, of course, on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify, help to push the podcast out to new people. Please leave those if you can. And please pray for me. I'm praying for you. Talk to you again very, very soon. Thanks for listening, guys, and God bless. This show is brought to you in a special way by our co-producer patrons over at patreon.com/cordialcafe. A special thanks to Ellie and Tom, Kelvin and Susan, Stephen, Suzanne and Victor, Phil, Noah, Nicole, Michelle, Jordan, John, James, Gina, and Aram for your special support at the co-producer tier and making this thing possible. You guys are fantastic. God bless and thanks for your support.